This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Blue jeans, ubiquitous. You can find them at the high-end designer boutiques anywhere in town or Amazon or Walmart. And they haven't always been that way. Jeans really originated as work garments for miners, farmers, and cattle workers. Their shape and form evolved alongside the American workforce, leading to the development of styles, overall changes in styles, overalls, Western jeans for cowboys, and lots more. Well, a new pop-up exhibit explores the history of denim wear and the important role that Greensboro played in the development of denim and denim apparel industries. Denim at the Depot is on view at the Douglas Galen Depot in downtown Greensboro. It's there through Sunday. We're going to give you a preview today. Joining me first is the exhibit curator, Evan Morrison. He's also co-owner of Hudson's Overall Company, a Greensboro-based small-batch producer of denim and other goods. Evan, welcome. Good to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Also, Susan Downer. She is works at BF Jeanswear, and that is a company that owns both Wrangler and Bluebell, and she's become a kind of in-house archivist for the company. Susan, welcome. Good to have you here as well.
Nice to be here.
Evan, let's start with the history of denim itself. Where does it come from? How did it come to the United States?
Sure. So you see it pop up as a fabric that was known as a durable work clothing fabric in Nîmes, France, and it is naturally, at that point, fabric from denim. So hence the name becomes abbreviated, you get denim, and is brought over through immigration to the United States and becomes, through the 19th century, the staple fabric for work clothing. And primarily at the end of the 19th century.
Sure, and it develops as a result of the Industrial Revolution. This is the original work garment, right?
Exactly.
Fabric, anyway. So how does it now, it comes over here, how does it get to Greensboro?
Well, it started in New England with the concentration of textile mills primarily being located where colonization occurs in the United States and trickles down to the South because of cheaper labor through the 19th and 20th centuries, which gives Greensboro the opportunity combined with the implementation of the North Carolina Railroad. So the two events sort of coincide at an intersection that gave Greensboro that opportunity.
And there was a kind of unhappy episode for the folks, I think, in Manchester, New Hampshire, that became the good luck of Greensboro. Is that right?
Right. So Amaskeag was a premier denim mill providing a lot of the work clothing manufacturers out in the West at the end of the 19th century. And through micro-depression, through strikes, through union issues, and then ultimately a flood and the Great Depression ends up closing its doors simultaneous to the rise of Greensboro's textile manufacturing.
And so then the mills are created. And the mills really kind of create a micro-economy in those early days, right?
That's correct. I mean, they build neighborhoods. They build trolley routes. They have their own banks, their own currencies, their own shopping centers, even their own schools, YMCAs, churches, and dairy farms.
And Susan, you've had a chance to look into those microeconomies and communities. Bluebell and Wrangler came into the picture in the early 1900s, am I right?
Yes, it did.
And the mill village culture, of course, was alive and well for other mills. It was already a textile industry, right?
Yes, Greensboro was a textile town. And C.C. Hudson, of course, started over a grocery store and actually started making overalls, and overalls would be used by the rail workers, by people around. Luckily, we had a lot of mills around to provide the denim, and so he had the workforce here to create the overalls.
Bib overalls, right? Mm-hmm. And the bell ringers. Tell us about the bell ringers, because again, this is a big part of mill culture, particularly around the denim industry.
Oh, yes. We have the bell ringers, and there are magazines and newsletters that were produced in-house by the employees because, again, it's a family atmosphere. This is where you worked, and this is a part of who you were. Again, it's the small community. I'd like to read you a little story about one of the workers, and it was a Miss Campbell who first came with the Hudson Overall Company, and she was there. She said there were 30 single needle machines, 3 felling machines, 2 button machines, 1 buttonhole, and no bottom hemmers. This type of work was done on plain machines. The material was spread by hand and cut with a hand knife through slots in the table using 24 pairs of garments on the table. They had cardboard patterns which were laid over the cloth and marked off with chalk. Mrs. Campbell adds that they were all thrilled when the first cutting machine was installed, which made the slotted table and large knife obsolete. She recalls with interest in those early days when Mr. Hudson offered a $10 award for a name for the Hudson Overall Company. One of the employees, whose name she does not recall, won the $10 award by suggesting the name of Bluebell Overall Company.
Oh, so it was an employee who gave it the name,
yes,
right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And Wrangler and Bluebell then merged at some point.
Well, Wrangler actually came from Bluebell. It was in 1947. It was after the war. And we had, work at that point in time of, as far as overalls and work clothing. We needed another extension, and we entered into the Wrangler, the cowboy business.
Well, and I guess, Evan, that gets us to the evolution of denim as jeans and overalls. If they're trying to fit these workforces, they have a lot of jobs. There are cowboys, there are miners, there are ranchers, and there are factory workers. And the design of those jeans changed to reflect all those occupations, right?
That's exactly right. So, construction, garment type, as well as fit, all become something that is relevant to each specific type of work.
And so on overalls, for instance, and wasn't it true that overalls were kind of great for farmers and for, folks who were doing kind of dirty work, but then if you're working on the range or mining, those bibs got in the way, so we had to make adjustments again, right?
Right. So, it sort of co-evolves on two different levels. You've got like the mining and Western work clothing that really is centric about waist overalls, which was at that time your standard pant with waist suspender buttons. And so in a lot of these old miner photos, you'll see the guys with rope on their waist as belt instead of suspenders or a bib front or apron front overall that we're accustomed to here in the Southeast. And that was merely because of the liability and risk that came with having something over your shoulder, catch it on something in a mine and all of a sudden it collapse. Whereas in the South, you see the rise of the apron front overall. Late 1700s, it was called, that particular garment was called slops. So you threw on your slops before going in like the pigsty and hung them on the nail when you leave. And, then it evolves into an actual physical garment worn over clothing to protect during work.
And Wrangler, really, Susan, starts to develop a niche market or exploit the niche market for cowboys, right? Talk about how those, and there was evolutions and changes in those designs as well, right?
Yes, because at the time, of course, there's always been cowboys. But we actually worked with Rodeo Ben, who was a designer for movies and for television shows for Roy Rogers and Gene Autry, and he came in and we worked with cowboys. We actually went to cowboys and said, what do you need in your product? What do you need to wear? And kept going back and forth with him, just trying to make the cowboy jean, that iconic Western jean that we were looking for.
And it's interesting. The styles change. We got them tucked in the boot, and then we got the flare to go around the boot, and it's going back and forth. What they could have done is just checked out Facebook, and then they could have gotten all those comments, aggregated those. I guess that didn't work as well. So we've talked about the fabric itself, denim, and how it got created, and the jean industry, of course, huge in Greensboro. But where did the blue come from? The blue, of course, comes from indigo. And to find out more about that, we are joined by Henry Wong. He is the Director of Product Development and Marketing at Artistic Fabric Mills. It's a denim supplier based in Pakistan, and he is an indigo expert. And he's in Pakistan right now looking into the history of indigo. Henry Wong, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Tell us about, first of all, how did you used to work for Cone Mills in Greensboro, right?
That's correct, years ago. For me, it was a dream job to be immersed in all of the history of denim. We're talking about over 100 years of history.
Why blue? I mean, it sort of never occurred to me. You can dye those things anything you want or nothing. When did indigo come into the picture, and how did the decision to dye them blue get made? Well, Henry's in Pakistan, and we may have lost the connection to Henry. Are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. So what was the decision? How did the decision get made to dye them blue, and where does indigo fit the picture?
Blue is a very difficult color to derive from nature. And indigo, luckily, allows us to achieve not only blue, but a very deep, color-fast dye stuff. We can make lots of garments look very dark in a fairly economical way, especially at the early 1900s and late 1800s, and throughout history.
blue is the royal color, too. So it's kind of interesting that what has become now identified with working folk was originally the royal color, right? This is the color of the rich and privileged.
You're right. And through various civilizations and cultures in history, blue, especially indigo blue, has always had this dynamic where it's considered a color of privilege as well as a color of the working class. We obviously have indigo blue in workwear, which now today has been transformed into, if you have a pair of premium denim jeans, it's a social status symbol. And we see this as well as in Japan and West Africa.
So tell us exactly what is indigo and how is that dye extracted?
Well, indigo for most of its history, and we're talking about over 4,000 years of history, was derived from plants. And there's over 700 plants that have indigo tin. And the one that we're most familiar with is Indigofera tinctoria. And the way that's extracted is basically through a process of steeping indigo leaves in a tea and allowing fermentation process to happen. And then from that point on, you can either reduce the vat and dye directly from that, or you can turn it into a exportable form like they did in India. And that would have made its way across to the United States.
Well, we're talking about this industry, and we're talking about it fondly, the fact that the denim industry was very strong in Greensboro, that it has this history, and, of course, folks writing in those newsletters so fondly about their memories. But it also, there is a dark side to all of this. I mean, it is part of the rise of industrialization and industrial capitalism relies on the exploitation of its workers. That happened, and segregation was an important part. You talked about the fact that wages were lower here. Segregation had something to do with that, and of course, a real anti-union atmosphere. So, I mean, that is also part of the history. We can't ignore that, Evan. You have your own company now, and it's interesting how things may have come in some ways full circle. Talk about your own denim company now and the way these companies now are situated in our environment as we reconstitute businesses in North Carolina.
Sure. So, I think one thing important to point out is that North Carolina is a great state to highlight as a maker movement state, with a lot of makers and manufacturers and merchants popping up over the past few years, specifically with this resurgence and concentration around Made in USA. So I think some of it is very trendy in the sense that it might not live a long lifespan, and those fakers might end up sort of timing out. But in terms of paying homage to the history of our state, one of the most represented with textile tourism in the 20th century, I found it very enchanting to relaunch something that plays to that same sort of melody. And so we've relaunched and refounded Hudson Overall Company, which, as you mentioned, was the original name that then became Bluebell. And we relaunched it above the old Co. grocery building, which has since moved 4 units down the street, but the old moniker still is apparent outside. And the goal is, we sell goods with purpose. So we make and manufacture items in small batch format that are made out of denim, canvas, and leather in-house, upstairs, on old antique industrial machines. And the idea is you come in and you meet your maker. Essentially, you meet the person that is either making or representing a friend of ours for the wares that we have. And it's been quite an interesting process. Having to deal with the retail side as well as the manufacturing side is not easy. But I think that in any case, Greensboro is the appropriate city to pay homage to our past.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see how, again, given the mixed history of textile industry in North Carolina, seeing it come back to life in these new forms, what you're doing just down the block from you in Burlington, TS Designs, Eric Henry, is creating ecosystems where we're talking about growing the cotton in North Carolina and fabricating retail material, T-shirts and such. So all of that becoming reconstituted is exciting stuff. Tell us about the exhibit, the pop-up exhibit. What are we going to see?
Sure. So at the exhibit, the idea is to highlight and showcase Greensboro's rich history in not just textile manufacturing being the fabric, but also apparel manufacturing being the finished goods. And so it has quite an expansive scope. Beginning, a lot of people know that Greensboro is named for General Greene from the Revolutionary War, but not a lot of people realize that his wife actually financed Eli Whitney's invention of the cotton gin on their plantation in Georgia. So that was back in the 1790s. And then through the 1800s and 1900s, we've become a textile and apparel manufacturing mecca, under the premise that this is for work clothing. So these durable fabrics are going into clothing that is being worked in. And then fast forward to present, and we are still home to the world's longest continuous operating denim mill, being White Oak Cotton Mills, as well as the world's largest consumer of denim, being VF Corporation, and they're also simultaneously the largest apparel holding company. So we still are the biggest apparel company, and we are the oldest denim manufacturer.
This is a pop-up exhibit through Sunday in Greensboro, but you're hoping for a permanent space someday, huh?
We are, and I think that there's a lot of viability, so we'll just have to keep forging our way and see where it goes.
All right, Evan, thank you so much. Evan Morrison, the curator of the new pop-up exhibit, Denim at the Depot, also the co-owner of Hudson's Overall Company, a Greensboro-based small batch producer. Thank you, Evan.
Thank you.
Also with us, Susan Downer, in-house archivist for VF Jeanswear, a company that owns both Wrangler and Bluebell. Thank you, Susan.
Oh, thank you.
And Henry Wong joined us on a line from Pakistan, the director of product development and marketing at Artistic Fabric Mills. Thanks, Henry.
Thank you very much.
Denim at the Depot, on view through this Sunday, September 27th at Douglas Galen Depot in downtown Greensboro. You can get all the web details at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton, and Andrew Tai. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. And North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.